Do you see the deals on these brands? Of course you can't. This is a podcast. But when you go to Ross this spring, you'll see brands you know at prices you love. We're talking all the shoes, hues, and ooze at 20 to 60% off department store prices. Go see the savings at Ross.
Skip and Jimmy Scandarito had an unusual father-son relationship. They drank together, did drugs together, and even chased women together.
Mr. Scandarito and his son also shared a secret life, a life that some of their friends knew about and some of them didn't.
In March 2018, it was spring break in Boca Raton, Florida. Skip Scandarito invited his old friend, Gary Gooden, to stay at his home. Skip, his son Jimmy, and friend Gary made plans to drink and play golf. But on one of those days, Skip's heart acted up, and they canceled plans. Later, Gary left, and so Jimmy and Skip played another round of golf. By the end of March, Skip Scandarito was dead.
I want you to focus on, and what I want you to think about, is that the defendant is a man who is fueled by greed. He is fueled by desire to live a lifestyle that he simply cannot afford. He is the sole beneficiary of his father's estate, and though it's not that much money, it's a lot more than what the defendant has. The defendant is an individual, James Scandarito II, who did everything he possibly could to get away with murder.
Easter Sunday fell on April 1st, 2018. 49-year-old James Scandarito Jr., also known as Jimmy, called the Boca Raton Police Department to report his 74-year-old father missing. He said his father, James Scandarito Sr., better known as Skip, went canoeing on a date and never returned. But detectives didn't trust the son's word, and when they started tracking his movements, they were shocked at what they found. In today's episode, I'm switching things up a bit, and I'm going to let the trial testimony tell the story of what happened to Skip Scandarito. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 81. Investigators found Skip's car a few days after he went missing. It was abandoned near a boat ramp at a park in Delray Beach, not far from where he lived. At first glance, nothing seemed out of the ordinary, but a receipt that was on the vehicle's floorboard caught their attention. It was a receipt from Home Depot from early in the morning on March 29th, and the purchases made were a one-gallon gas container and a hand cart. When investigators pulled the surveillance video, they noted that Jimmy Scandarito was the purchaser of the odd items. With Jimmy now on their radar, they tracked his movements to an abandoned golf course, where they eventually found Skip's remains. He had been dismembered, and several of his body parts were found in separate suitcases. But when they went to go arrest Jimmy, he was nowhere to be found. Jimmy was finally apprehended on April 9th, 2018, 300 miles away from his apartment in Fort Lauderdale, and 8 days after reporting his father missing. He was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and abuse of a dead human body. Prosecutors said Jimmy killed his father and that he did it for the money, for the $800,000 he stood to inherit. Jimmy first went to trial in November 2018, but a mistrial was declared because of a medical emergency with one of his attorneys. At his second trial, in March 2019, Jimmy took the stand in his own defense. He says he's innocent, that he did not kill his father. He explained in detail that he was in a drug-fueled paranoia after finding his deceased father, and that he was too afraid to call the police because he didn't want them to find his drugs. He then described chopping up his father, limb by limb, dismembering the body so he could get rid of it instead. The story sounds unbelievable, But the question is, what would the jury think?
Good afternoon. Jimmy Scandarito, who is the defendant in this case, did not kill Skip Scandarito. And there is no evidence that supports that. This is an entirely circumstantial case.
That's Elizabeth Ramsey. She's Jimmy's attorney. She made her opening statements to a Palm Beach County, Florida jury on March 11th, 2019. She said Jimmy was an unplanned and unexpected child born in the late 60s. His first experimentations with marijuana, alcohol, cocaine, and with other drugs were in the presence of his father. Not only did Jimmy and his dad do drugs together, but they engaged in the sale of drugs, too. She told the court that Skip was a retired Michigan District Court judge. While on the bench, he was accused of offering women leniency in exchange for sexual favors. He retired amongst the allegations and moved to Florida with his wife, Terry. She passed away in 2017. She told the jury that Skip had heart concerns and even had a triple bypass surgery. On the night of March 28, 2018, Skip and his son had been drinking and partying in memory of Terry's birthday. Jimmy went outside to speak on the phone to his girlfriend, and when he came back inside, he found his father dead.
Mr. Scandarito was lying in the living room area as if he had fallen face forward off of an automated lounging chair onto the ground. He felt slightly cooler to the touch than one would expect. It looked like he had vomited or frothed a little bit from the mouth. Mr. Scandarito's efforts to wake him and to revive him were unsuccessful. They had been partying all day, and there was a slew of legal and illegal drugs on a coffee table that was spilled over in the living room.
She described the scene and noted that there was no evidence of any kind of violence.
There were no broken dishes. There were no pillows tossed around. There was no furniture turned over. There was no blood. There was no broken glass. There was nothing out of the ordinary because there was no fight. There was no struggle. And Jimmy Scandarito did not kill his father.
But prosecutor Emily Walters argued that Jimmy did kill his father. She described the scene when Skip's body was found by investigators. She said that in the early morning hours of April 4th, 2018, a deputy and his canine partner, Tucker, went to an abandoned golf course. Tucker went over to a shallow sand pit that had been recently covered and pawed at it. He then alerted that there were human remains inside that pit.
The police uncover what's underneath, and it absolutely shocks their senses. It is gruesome. It is despicable. What is inside that shallow pit are two garbage bags. Both have blue drawstrings. One of them has duct tape wrapped around it. In one of the garbage bags is the upper torso of a human being with the head cut off, decapitated. Both arms have also been cut off, and it is sawed halfway through, and there are organs inside. In the other bag, which is a little bit more open, there's the bottom half of the torso from the waist down to the legs, with the bottom legs cut off as well. And it is in a state of decomposition. It has been there for a little while, and it smells. And you're going to hear about that smell. Ladies and gentlemen, the state's evidence will show you that the defendant in this case, James Scandarito II, is responsible for the murder and abuse of the human body of his own father.
The state called a slew of witnesses to the stand. Officers, detectives, crime scene investigators, and the medical examiner. all of which you'll hear from throughout this episode. Prosecutors presented evidence the state believes shows that Jimmy not only chopped up his father's body, but that he had murdered his father before doing so. Then the state rested. Up next was the defense's case. The spectators and reporters in the courtroom waited anxiously to hear the judge ask Jimmy the standard, "Sir, will you testify at your own trial?" question. Jimmy replied, "Yes." And so the defense called their key witness, their only witness, the defendant, James Scandarito Jr., to testify in his own defense.
So you cooked together that night?
I don't do much cooking, no. But okay. My dad does it on the grill, and we warm some things up in the microwave.
Okay, and you ate with him?
Yes.
Jimmy is describing the night of March 28th, 2018. He's the last known person to see or talk to his father alive. And it was at his father's house where he says he found him dead.
And you were watching TV at that time with your father?
We were. I think Survivor was on at that time.
Okay. From 8 to 9?
I think it's on 8 to 9, yeah.
Okay. All right. And so after you finished watching Survivor that night, what do you do?
You know, we start probably watching an NBA game. I'm chatting with, you know, girlfriend, probably some other people. And prior to that, I actually started doing some cocaine. My dad didn't want to do any. He said he had a good buzz. And, you know, I knew he was going to get up the next morning early to go play tennis. Or go watch the tennis match. So he didn't partake in any, which wasn't unusual.
He said his dad doesn't let him smoke cigarettes inside the house, and so he went out to the back patio by the pool to sit and smoke. It was about 9:45 when he first went out there. When asked when he next saw his father, he said around 11:30 when he went back inside.
I come in the back door, and I don't see him in the chair at the back patio door. I don't see him in the chair. And as I come around, I see him. He's on the floor, kind of on his side between the table and his chair, kind of with his head rested against the couch. And I yell, "Dad, are you okay?" And no response. Thought maybe he just passed out or something. So I kind of grab him and shake him a little bit, and nothing. I checked his pulse at his neck. There was no pulse at all. I tried to roll him over. I mean, it's kind of a tight little quarters there. I kind of tried to roll him over and pushing on his chest, and there's no response. He feels like he's not, his body temperature isn't what it normally is. What, you know, it feels not cold, but like it had happened, you know, a little bit before then, certainly.
He looked around and saw cocaine all over.
He had knocked over all of the cocaine that was on the cake server, the appetizer server. That was on the floor, was on the couch. It was on him, and he was just kind of laying in it. And my once I saw all of that, my first reaction was that he might have done a line of cocaine and just passed out onto the table.
So you thought that he had perhaps overdosed or caused his death by the use of, a plethora of drugs that night?
Yeah.
Okay, and did that worry you?
Yeah, I was scared to death. You know, I was very worried.
Elizabeth Ramsey asked Jimmy about his state of mind.
What was your mindset at this time? Were you sober?
No. I was more buzz drunk and high and stoned than he was, certainly because of the cocaine that I had done. And you get paranoid sometimes when you do cocaine. So the first, you know, my first reaction was, "Oh no, you know, I'm gonna get in trouble because he died snorting my cocaine, you know. But I had to. My next thought was I got to clean up all of this cocaine. I got to, you know, we had a box of edibles there. I got to get rid of that, you know. And you know, honestly, I didn't. You know, I should have called 911, but I didn't want to face them in my current state, talking to the police and talking to, you know, any ambulance people at that time.
Okay.
That was my, you know, I mean, it's, I don't know, as terrible as it sounds, I was afraid.
He said his dad was a large man, around 220 pounds and a couple inches taller than him. He said he tried to move his body, but couldn't.
And so when you couldn't lift him and you couldn't clean up the drugs from around him, what did you do?
I mean, I thought I needed to find a way to move him, you know, out, either put him into this bed or just move him enough so I can clean up.
At 6:06 a.m. later that morning, Jimmy was seen on surveillance video at Home Depot purchasing a hand truck and gas can in cash.
And so at that point in time when you buy the dolly, what is your plan for how you're going to handle it?
Well, I mean, I would never say I ever had a plan, you know. My thought was to kind of roll him over onto the dolly and then pull him out by that point, you know, it had been, I don't know, 7 hours, 6 or 7 hours maybe since he had passed away. You know, maybe I should just put him in his bed. That way I could, when I woke up, you know, he was dead in his bed. And I needed to, you know, finish making sure that there was no cocaine or marijuana stuff in the family room area.
Jimmy says he rested the dolly against the couch and kind of worked his father's body onto it.
Dolly's long. I mean, I don't know, it's 4 or 5 feet. My dad's 6 feet. So once you get into the hallway, you have to kind of lift it up to turn it. And that's when, you know, problems occurred in terms of him starting to fall off the dolly, you know, me banging it into the walls. I couldn't balance him on the dolly and work it around the tight corner of the hallway, and I ended up just kind of falling and dropping, you know, the dolly with him on it, and just kind of breaking down and crying at that point, like, what the hell, you know, what has just happened, what's going on, you know, just the whole enormity of the situation.
It was now around 7 a.m., and Jimmy said he remembers that his father had plans to see a tennis match at the Miami Open with his neighbor, Betty Butcher. So he took his dad's phone and sent Betty a text canceling their dates. Betty testified for the state, and she described getting that text message. She said she had just gotten dressed when she received the message, saying that he was sorry that he was not able to go, that he was going to instead spend the day with his son because it was his deceased wife's birthday.
Miss Butcher, how did you feel when you got that text?
I was very unhappy about that text.
Was it?
I said okay because I had no other choice.
Did you feel disappointed?
Well, I can understand if, you know, a person has a reason like that, but at the same time, you should have known last night, the night before.
Did it appear to you to be out of character with what you know about Mr. Scandarito?
Right, he would normally have called me.
And did you ever receive a phone call that morning?
No.
Did you ever speak to Mr. Scandarito again?
No.
After sending Betty the text, Jimmy put his father's body back onto the dolly and was able to get it into the garage. But he said he was worried that his neighbors might see his dad's car in the driveway and come over to say hi, so he drove his dad's car to a nearby parking lot. Then he walked back to the house. Jimmy then drove back to his own home in Fort Lauderdale, but unable to sleep, he drove back to his dad's. Later that afternoon, he went to a Publix grocery store to buy household cleaners, cigarettes, and beer.
I basically come to the realization that I'm not going to be able to load my father's body into the back of his truck if I'm going to, bury it, or if I'm going to, do something to remove him from the house.
And you're not going to be able to get him back into the bed?
No, when I couldn't move him through the hallway and he fell off the cart, I mean, he had stiffened up at that point. I didn't, test his arms in terms of like that, but he was stiffening. And I, at that point, I kind of knew that there was, even if I tried to find a friend or somebody that would help me, there was no way that he would probably be in a natural position in the bed after he had been on the floor, earlier, all night. And
put him back on the floor.
I mean, I had already moved his body. I had already, I don't know. I mean, I guess I thought that at this point now, I've already moved his body. I've already went out, going to Walmart, going to Home Depot, to move him back. I watch CSI. I'm sure somebody could have told that I had moved the body,
He went back to the Publix to buy garbage bags, towels, duct tape, and a mop. He then went to get a bite to eat, all while using his father's debit card. His attorney questioned him on what the duct tape was for. He said he had purchased that in order to secure his father's body to the dolly. He said by that time, he knew what he was going to do.
By the time that you go home at, roughly 6:30, 7 o'clock that night, have you decided in your mind what you're going to have to do?
I have.
And what was that?
That I'm going to have to dismember my dad to be able to move him out of the house.
Jimmy said he taped his father's body onto the dolly and began to dismember him. At this point in court, describing the action, Jimmy begins to cry on the stand.
So you have heard the medical examiner talk about the fact that the body is cut from essentially back to front?
Yes.
Okay. Does his body remain on the dolly while you are cutting it?
Yeah, because I rolled the dolly over when I am doing the dismembering of the extremities.
Okay. And so you are cutting those portions that are hanging off of the dolly?
Yes.
He said he found a handsaw in the garage and used it to cut his dad's body into pieces.
And when you are actually cutting him, are you doing that underneath the top part?
Yes.
And why is that?
Because I can't look at what I'm doing. I just can't. I take a garbage bag and I kind of cover the part that is being dismembered. So when the arm, let's say, is finally dismembered, it's kind of falls into the garbage bag.
Jimmy said he took frequent breaks while doing this to smoke and vomit. Eventually, he put the pieces of the body into three suitcases. He thinks it was around 7 o'clock in the morning when he finished. According to trial testimony, the next day, on Saturday, March 31st, Skip's friend Gary Gooden arrived at Skip's house. Jimmy told him that his father was out kayaking. Later that day, Gary became concerned that Skip hadn't shown up to watch a basketball game as they had planned, so Gary and Jimmy tried calling him. Gary said his calls went straight to voicemail, and so he went to bed. When Skip still hadn't arrived home the next morning, Gary called around to local hospitals, and then he called the police department to file a missing persons report. According to police, Jimmy told the detectives who came to the home that he had met his father at the South Winds Golf Course on March 28th to play a round of golf. He said he ran some errands and then went back to his father's home. They were drinking tequila to celebrate his mother's birthday, and Skip told him that he was going to the Miami Open tennis match with his friend Betty. Jimmy said he then went back home to his place in Fort Lauderdale and then came back in the afternoon to help his dad clean out his garage. He said he didn't see or speak to his father on March 30th. He said he then went to his father's house on March 31st to watch the basketball game, but his father never showed up. Police issued a missing persons alert, and local media asked residents to keep their eyes out for Skip. Investigators would later find Skip's car in Delray Beach, but they didn't find his cell phone, wallet, or keys in the car. What they found was that Home Depot receipt on the floor of the passenger side of the vehicle. On April 3rd, police returned to Skip's house. They walked around the home with Jimmy and noticed that he became uneasy when they went into the garage. They left the home, obtained a search warrant, and returned shortly thereafter. This is Detective Scott Hanley with the Boca Raton Police Department.
We informed the defendant and Mr. Gooden that we would be securing the residence for the application of a search warrant and that they would need to exit the residence at that time.
And did both Mr. Gooden and the defendant comply?
Not initially.
Can you tell the members of the jury what happened when you initially made that statement?
Mr. Gooden seemed to be okay with it. Defendant was verbally confrontational about it. Didn't really understand the need for a search warrant. Didn't think we had to go to that extent. And was a little bit reluctant to leave the residence.
The detectives noticed one area of the garage that was uncluttered. The floor beneath that area was much cleaner than the rest of the garage floor. Crime scene investigators used something called Blue Star, which showed that there was a blood-like substance in Skip's garage and kitchen that had been cleaned up. The hand truck Jimmy had purchased at Home Depot also tested positive for presumptive blood.
Do you ever ask him where he thought his father was?
Yes, at one point during the walkthrough, I just said off-cuff to him, "Where do you think your dad is?"
And what was his response?
He immediately responded at the bottom of the intercoastal.
Jimmy didn't know it at the time, but investigators had decided to watch his movements. A sheriff's office Eagle helicopter pilot was flying in a chopper, tracking him as he drove to and from his father's house that following night. Helicopter pilot Deputy John Reed testified that he watched Jimmy walk onto an abandoned golf course in Boca Raton at around 4 in the morning, nearly 8 days after his father's death.
I want to say it's about halfway through our second order. I pick up an individual that was in and around this area right here on this end of the condominium here.
And what did you see that individual doing?
He was walking across the golf course, or coming out from the golf course toward the condominium in this direction, as the letter pointed to him, and he was dragging what appeared to be a suitcase to me.
He saw him leave the golf course, go to a car in the parking lot, and load the suitcase and other items in his hand into the trunk. He then watched as Jimmy got into the car, exited the parking lot, and drove over to a dumpster.
And what did you see when you saw him go into that area?
He pulled into the parking lot, went to the back portion, kind of in this corner here, and there's a dumpster that was in the back part of the parking lot. He pulled up in front of that dumpster there.
And what did he do when he pulled up in front of the dumpster?
He got out of the vehicle, opened the trunk, got out what looked to be the suitcase that I had seen earlier, and put it over into the dumpster.
Deputy Reed relayed this information to investigators, and by 6 a.m., they had swarmed the dumpster, later describing smelling a strong odor of decomposition coming from inside. Once they opened up the dumpster, officers found the suitcase, along with a smaller suitcase inside of it. Inside was bloody clothing, maggots, and a gas can. DNA results on the two suitcases were either inconclusive or could not exclude Skip as a contributor. Next, the investigators made their way to the abandoned golf course. They used canine Tucker to sniff for the scent of decomposition, and sure enough, Tucker signaled at a sand pit. Inside the 4-foot-deep hole in the sand pit on the golf course were the remains of Skip Scandarito. They found his torso and the top part of his legs. A dive team then found a shovel in a small pond on the course. Investigators then brought the portions of Skip's body they had found to the medical examiner. Dr. Richard Mote performed the autopsy.
So tell us then about the initial autopsy procedure. What do you do after making those external locations?
I dissect them. I take surgical instruments, I open them up, I look on the inside. I look for things like trauma, I look things like natural disease. I take samples for drug testing, and that's documented.
Did you observe any signs of external trauma on the portions of the body that you observed other than the dismemberment?
No.
Tell us about your internal examination of Mr. Scandarito.
I mean, essentially, he's decomposing. I found out internal trauma in the parts that I examined. He had heart disease, meaning his arteries in his heart were full of cholesterol. They had done bypass surgery several years before to bypass and try to fix that. So they take blood vessels. It's like when you have a clogged pipe at home. They'll take a pipe and bypass that area, and that's what they do. That's why they call it bypass surgery. They bypass the bad artery and connect it to a good spot so you can get blood flowing through the heart again. His heart was a little heavy, and it was a little bit large.
The medical examiner ruled the cause and manner of death as homicide by unspecified means. Dr. Mote said that Skip had marijuana in his system, along with slight amounts of alcohol and a therapeutic amount of prescription painkillers. Nothing that he was concerned about, he said. He saw no evidence of any cocaine or other drugs. Dr. Mote told the jury that he never saw a case of dismemberment that was also not a homicide. But on cross-examination, he was asked if he had seen case examples the defense had cited in a motion in which defendants had been convicted of dismemberment after the victim had overdosed on drugs.
Were you aware then at all of prior cases in which individuals have dismembered people after there were drug overdoses?
Before that, no.
Okay. But you are aware of that now?
That's correct.
Okay. That there are easily within the last 3 years, more than 8 cases involving individuals who were convicted of dismembering individuals after those individuals had overdosed on drugs.
I'm aware of it now.
Okay. And, I mean, as a medical examiner, you yourself have had many cases in which people have overdosed on drugs.
Yes.
Right? And if somebody is present during the overdose of an individual or provides drugs to someone who is overdosed, there could be criminal liability for that.
There could be, yes.
Okay. And so that's the reason why somebody might be afraid to report a drug overdose to the police.
Yes.
Okay. So at this point in time, sir, we can agree that there are situations other than homicide in which dismemberment occurs.
Correct.
Okay.
I've had cases where people in panic and just dumped a body but not dismembered.
Okay, you personally.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But we can agree that there are other instances in which people actually have dismembered people to get rid of the body because they're so afraid of reporting a drug overdose that occurs in their presence.
Yes.
Dr. Mote also acknowledged that he couldn't rule out a natural death or an overdose.
And so just to be clear, sir, with regard to the actual physical examination of Mr. Scandarito in this case, there is nothing about the medical examination that would allow you to rule out heart attack as a cause of death?
Only focusing on the medical findings without any other information, that's correct.
Okay. There is nothing that would allow you to rule out stroke?
That's correct. I don't have the head, so I can't rule that in or out.
And there is nothing that would allow you to accurately calculate the level of narcotics in Mr. Scandarito's body.
In his blood, that's correct.
He said he noted jagged tool marks in the neck, back, and spine bones, showing that someone had used a handsaw to cut through them. He could tell the person stopped and repositioned the saw at certain points. According to Dr. Mote, this would not have been difficult to do. He said a lack of bruising on Skip's body suggested that he was dismembered after he was already dead. Despite this testimony that it wouldn't have been difficult to do, Jimmy told the jury that it took him a long time.
I mean, it seemed like I was doing it all night. I mean, I know Dr. Mote said it was easy. And maybe it's not, you know, physically strenuous. But, you know, it wasn't, it was not something that I, it was a quick, it was a long time. I would take frequent, breaks, go out through the garage door, and to the outside of the house, the side of the house, have cigarettes, smoke cigarettes, and just, you know, wish that this nightmare wasn't happening.
The prosecution had their chance to cross-examine Jimmy. They focused their questions largely on a potential financial motive for why they say Jimmy killed his father. On the day of Skip's death, Jimmy logged onto his Bank of America account 6 times. When he logged in that night at 9:30 p.m., he had a total of $3.40 in his account. According to records, Jimmy stood to inherit $800,000 from his father.
But in your version of what happens, before you're, even at the part where you're dismembering your father, you're taking money out of the bank account and putting it into yours, right?
Yes, but I knew that money wasn't going to come in for 5-6 days because it was through Stripe. So it's not like I was taking it to use at that point in time.
Right.
If I needed that kind of money, why wouldn't I take out all the money that I needed? If I needed money.
Because you wanted to make sure that your father was declared missing. That's why you came up with a story that you told the police. Right? So you could get all of his money and his house.
That was... No.
What was never recovered was Skip Scandarito's head and his arms. Jimmy had claimed that he put them in a third suitcase and then put that suitcase in a dumpster at a nearby condo building, but they were never found. This was something that during the live streaming of the trial puzzled many experts at the Law and Crime Network. Here's forensic death investigator and professor at Jacksonville State University, Joseph Scott Morgan, explaining why he thinks this is significant.
We're making a big deal out of the head because from a forensic standpoint, therein may lie some answers as to causality of death and manner of death at the end of the day. You know, if Jimmy is so keen on letting us know that he dismembered the body, cool, that, I'm fine with that. Now that the dust is settled, why don't you just, you know, tell us where the head is so that we can go and take a look? What if that head and those arms are recovered at some point in time? And let me tell you the forensic value that those items hold, okay? They hold for the head. We can talk about natural disease. Did he have a stroke? The head, we can talk about trauma. Is the skull fractured? Is there a gunshot wound in it? Was he bludgeoned? And as far as the hands and the arms, you know, those things indicate for us in the forensic field potentially signs of marks of defense. Was he raising his arm at any point in time? Does he have scratches on his hands? Does he have any kind of bruising on his hands or contusions? You know, so that door is always left open.
The minute that we called the police, you know, I knew I was, you know, this was going to end badly.
As the police were closing in, Jimmy fled. He stole a license plate off a car, put it on his own, and started driving north. On April 9th, almost 2 weeks after Skip's death, a deputy in North Central Florida pulled Jimmy over while he was driving on Interstate 75. The deputy reported finding two passports and information for a private jet inside his car. A forensic exam of his computer found that he was researching countries without extradition to the United States. Investigators said he tried to fraudulently withdraw $9,500 from an account in his father's name and withdrew all of the money in his own bank accounts. Jimmy was arrested and later extradited to Palm Beach County. In her closing arguments, Assistant State's Attorney Emily Walters highlighted Jimmy's financial issues. She said that as of March 2018, he only had a few dollars in the bank and had been relying on his father to help him pay his bills. She said it's a reasonable inference that his dad was tired of bailing him out, and she pointed out that he had transferred $1,400 into his account prior to butchering his father. She also said that Jimmy believed he would never get caught. That's why he was so careless when he was caught on surveillance video at Home Depot. He dismembered his father because he wanted to ensure that no one would ever find his dad's body.
Because his goal at that point was to ensure that nobody would ever find his dad's body. That's the goal. What he underestimated was the fact that the Boca Raton Police Department has an undercover surveillance operation team. That one he didn't expect.
She also said it's significant that all the body parts still have yet to be found.
And remember, ladies and gentlemen, today we still do not have his dad's head. We still do not have his head. That is significant, ladies and gentlemen. He did not ever intend for any of that body to be found because he knew what it would reveal. He knew what it would reveal.
She said he killed and dismembered his father, period. In their closing arguments, Jimmy's attorney said that Jimmy did not kill his father and that the prosecution did not present enough evidence to prove that he did. The killing didn't happen, he said. He said their job as jurors is not to judge Jimmy as a person, but to decide if he killed Skip. He told them not to let their feelings get in the way of logic and common sense. It's easy to hate him, he said, but that doesn't change the law. After the closing arguments, the question of whether or not Jimmy killed his father was in the hands of the jury. Would Jimmy be convicted of murder? Was it a cold, calculated killing followed by chopping up his body, as the state said? Or did it happen as Jimmy and the defense said? Did he find his father dead, panic, and dismember his body? After about 10 hours of deliberation, there was a knock on the door. The jury had reached a verdict.
State of Florida, plaintiff versus James Scandarito II, defendant, verdict. We, the jury, find as follows. As to count one, we find the defendant not guilty. As to count two, we find the defendant guilty of abuse of a dead human body as charged in the indictment. So say we all, this 21st day of March, 2019, in West Palm Beach County, Florida, signed jury foreperson.
Not guilty of murder, but guilty of the dismemberment. The jury had found Jimmy's testimony credible. After the verdict was read, Jimmy nodded his head and mouthed thank you to the jury. Ellie Scandarito, Skip's niece and Jimmy's cousin, provided a statement on behalf of Skip's family. Quote, the defendant in this case, who we do not even consider a member of this family, was acquitted of a murder charge today. All he had to do to be acquitted of a murder charge was hide the body parts of his own father. The family is not okay with this. She said the defense made a joke of this case and that justice has not been served. Prior to Jimmy's sentencing, his attorneys filed a memorandum stating that Jimmy has been in jail for 14 months now, and they asked that he be released into drug offender probation or inpatient treatment. They said Jimmy was actually the victim, that he had never been able to establish a legal career, even though he had a law degree, due to his father's notoriety. They also said that Skip's dependency on alcohol and drugs encouraged Jimmy to start using too, and that Skip was too much of a friend and too little of a parent. At Jimmy's sentencing, Ellie Scandarito and another family member asked the judge to sentence him to the highest possible punishment, which was 15 years in prison. This is Judge John Castronakis handing down his sentence.
If that relationship is truly a loving relationship, you don't dismember your father. So it makes it much more, I'll use the word despicable, that you would do that to your own father and dismember someone who you had a close relationship. Yes, the father had his own problems in life. There are many people who love his father, including, you know, and this is his only child. His only child. And it's really, really very sad that Mr. Scandarito would do this to his own father. So, in looking at the totality of the evidence in this case, I've reviewed the sentencing memorandums, I've heard from everyone. I believe that the punishment that is appropriate in this case is, in fact, 15 years in the Department of Corrections with credit for 439 days.
So Jimmy will spend the next 13 years or so in prison for the dismemberment of his father. As for whether or not he will get his father's $800,000 inheritance, that has yet to be revealed. Florida has something called a slayer statute, which is intended to stop killers from profiting from their crimes. Skip's sister and niece have filed a lawsuit using this statute to disqualify him. As of this recording, Skip's head and arms still have not been recovered. But even if they are, someday, and even if those parts tell the story of a murder, because he was acquitted, Jimmy would never be able to be charged with it anyway. And that's all for this episode. I'd love to know your thoughts on this case. What did you make of the verdict? Do you believe Jimmy's testimony that he dismembered his father, but that he didn't kill him? Or do you think he got away with murder? Let me know by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, by joining our conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Today's episode was written and produced by Jennifer Tintner from Law and Crime. You can follow her on Twitter at Jennifer Tintner. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.